David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 384. I'm your host, Steve Raker, sitting here in the comic book bunker, happy to be connected to my pals. Or are they psychotic representations of a bad case of dissociative disorder, and they're not here at all? Tell me, do you all hear them too? It's Whirlwind X, Kevin, and Andrew the LA Rabbit, I think.
I'm wearing my giant bird skeleton right now.
It's going to come out, Steve, that you're like Phil Hendry and you just do all these voices on your on your own.
The bird skeleton thing is not a confidence builder. Marvel Noise is the semi-monthly podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. Our scope is all things Marvel, with a particular fondness for and fascination with the Bronze Age.
And the early 90s.
Thanks to Kevin.
You can exactly
find, listen to, stream, and download episodes past and present over on marvelnoise.com with the handy little calendar-style drop-down menu on the right-hand side so you can easily jump to past months and years. You can get new episode announcements, give feedback, and see images and cover galleries on our Facebook and Twitter pages. And don't forget to find other fine podcasts from our podcasting Hall of Fame worthy host, Derek Howard, and his Deliberate Noise Network. Check out Indie Comic Book Noise, in fact. It's our sister show, where we talk indie comics. Before we get to our main feature, let's pad this episode out with a quick recent reads roundtable. What you got, Andrew?
Oh. On the spot, right away. Uh-huh. Well, as usual, I'm breaking the rules, Steve.
Oh, no.
I'm not going to talk about a book published by Disney. Wait, I don't think they're Disney. Wait, let me check. Maybe they are Disney, and I just lied.
Andrew, we are...
I don't think so.
We are scheduled to record an Indie Comic Book Noise this week, just remember.
I'm
just
kidding. I'm talking about a book published by Penguin Press, All the Marvels, by Douglas Woke.
He's a good guy.
Don't know if you guys heard about this book or not.
Heard about it, didn't read it, was intrigued, though, to hear more.
Okay, basically the premise is Douglas Woke is a critic. I was unfamiliar with his work and a comic book fan. So he decided he was going to undertake reading roughly all of the Marvel Comics output with a whole bunch of asterisks around that. Huh. And the nice thing is, in the contents of the book, he kind of lays out his rough rules for what he was considering. Like, some of the licensed stuff is in, like the Shang-Chi, and I think he read the Godzilla, but he didn't read Transformers. And, you know, it was a weird, like, he has his different rules and everything. But the point of it is more not to get hung up on that stuff. And that's what I really liked about it. So in the beginning, he kind of lays out, like, what his parameters were. And also some guidelines and viewpoints, which I really liked. Like, don't necessarily start from the beginning. Like, pick a point that's interesting. The book's kind of written for non-comic book people, but I think only comic book people are going to read it. So, but it's a nice idea about, like, don't get hung up on having to start at the beginning. Like, pick, either get referred or pick something that looks interesting and start. It's going to be confusing, but you're going to figure it out. These things are kind of built to be figured out on the fly. And instead of stressing about the beginning or whatever, you should just find what resonates with you. And that was another important point, is like, if something isn't working, skip it. Like, read something else. Because he was like, he doesn't recommend doing this. Like, there's a lot of stuff you're going to go through that isn't for you. And that's fine. I would have perhaps stressed that maybe you want to think about, I feel comic books are very, as commercial art kind of fall into trends. So you may find that how Marvel wrote their comics in the 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever the trend was, may not suit you. So don't beat yourself, like, don't kill yourself. The whole point of this is to enjoy and discover and let the worlds unfold. That being said, he also takes a look at some of the major properties, Spider-Man, Avengers, X-Men, gives his take, kind of generally what the seminal version is, which is usually the first one. You know, Lee Kirby for Fantastic Four, Lee Ditko, and then a little bit of Romita for Spider-Man. The X-Men's a little bit different because for him, he kind of drills in on the Claremont era as more kind of the one, and sort of goes through and tries to extrapolate from reading thousands of the comic books, sort of kind of trends and messages. And it's less about whether you agree or disagree. It's just interesting to read someone who's trying to pull out broader trends after reading all these books. And his joy and enthusiasm is what won it over. This is a hustle. Like, he's getting someone to pay him to read all these books. So you need to be charismatic and have fun. And, like, there's one way where you go where you could be really snarky and cynical. But I responded much more to his positivity. I will say there's a bit at the end where he explains some of the genesis of this. Not going to spoil it, but that really explained it to me and drove home sort of why and how this works. And I just really was like, I don't think it's something I'm going to return to. It's not like I keep a lot of the sort of historical books, the Untold History of Marvel and some of those other biographies and my Ditko reference books and all that stuff. This one I don't know is one you return to, but it's really fun to think about because, you know,
that's cool.
We get into the sometimes the very minute, you know, we'll read a run or something, but it's I never really think about Spider-Man over 5,000 issues or what, like what cycles and concepts and broader themes. It's just not my jam. So what I get out of comic books, I will say, Kevin, he didn't index all the specific issues. He just picks at random, but I feel like he might've not had enough 90s. If I had to pick a decade, he does. And then he does fun stuff. Like he talks about presidents that appeared in Marvel Comics or music or, you know, cause there's real pop culture reference, Kiss and whatever, but also Dazzler's a musician. So just, I think it lays out concepts and the weird thing about how Marvel has that sliding time scale, because, you know, Reed Richards and them didn't go up in a rocket in the 60s and letting those books from the, like, just sort of the weirdness of it all. I don't know, I'd be interested if a non-comic person read it, but I don't know what non-comic person's gonna read it.
Yeah, I don't know if they could, it would hold their interest.
Yeah, I mean, what's the, like, I describe a book about a guy that pick a hobby you're not into that is really into scrimshaw and like carved 50,000 pieces of scrimshaw. Like, you're maybe not going to read that. Like, you're like, I don't care about scrimshaw. So
yeah, I'm not going to read a history of the NFL or anything.
Yeah. So
I'll tell you though, having taken courses in my lifetime, classes of study that were of subject matter that didn't interest me, it sure as heck helped to have an enthusiastic teacher who was really into the material. That makes a big difference. And I found that it was a more valuable use of my academic time to be exposed to stuff that maybe I wouldn't have sought out on my own, but it was presented to me so enthusiastically by someone who actually knew the stuff because they liked it so much that they found things. You know, people being excited about stuff that they know a lot about, and they can make it, you know, maybe not accounting, but other things, you know, almost everything else.
Well, I really like the message, and I try and give it to new comic readers, and that is read what you like. Like, there's no required reading. Like, if something isn't clicking, ditch it. Like, life's too short. This isn't homework or whatever. Like, fine. And it might be that, like, certain eras, as you guys know, I keep returning to, and some don't click well with me. I would say, Steve, you and I differ on this. Silver Age DC, just, I can't get into it for some reason. But Silver Age Marvel, I really like. I don't, it's just, not one's better than the other or whatever. It's just more what I vibe to. So, that's an important message for everyone. You know, this isn't something I don't know. And I like that enthusiasm in the community sense. Like, he used a lot of online resources and talked to people and reference about, you know, thinking about what goes what and what he should read and just tracking down some of these issues that, on, you know, he admits, I think he read some pirate books here or there, whatever, mm-hmm. you know.
Andrew,
like some of that stuff from the 60s, because he dipped back a little bit into the monster era and the romance era, too.
You tried to bait me into a DC debate there. I caught that. I'm not falling for it, though.
But yeah, fun, if that sounds like your thing. Like I said, don't know that I necessarily agree. I feel like from a 1,000-foot level, you can extrapolate pretty broad messages from Spider-Man and sort of make them fit in a way that maybe isn't, but it's a nice thought exercise at a minimum. And
right.
I mean, certainly got me. I think I might go reread whole as a complete run, the Ditko Spider-Man.
Yeah. I mean,
like, you know what? I've got a few other things on the back burner, but that's up for a complete reread to try and see how it spells out. But that has to do with something else. I was also going to reference on the sister show Indie Noise.
See, so that's perfect, because you don't need a guide, right? Like, you've been around long enough that you don't need somebody to tell you what Spider-Man's all about, that kind of thing. So to have again someone be excited about what their stuff is, and then there's a couple of things, oh yeah, you know what, I should reread that, I really like that thing too, or that's cool. This sounds like a great beach book, or sitting in the hammock next to a waterfall, hanging out, just reading. This sounds like a great backpack beach book.
Well, like I said, the whole idea of, like, sometimes I just read parts of runs or whatever, and that maybe if you read the whole thing, you're going to see more of where it's going. I mean, we're already heading that direction. I mean, I'm pretty much have abandoned reading single floppies half most of the time. Usually I'm reading at least two or three, or sometimes 5 or 10 or whatever. So it's weird how the books, and those books in the 60s were not built for that, really. It's kind of fascinating.
Yeah. Cool.
Just different ways to engage with the hobby that are fun.
You but are like allowed I said, to engage
I don't know, does
with
Penguin
the hobby
own,
different ways.
Does Disney own Penguin? Was this really a Disney book?
If so, they would copyright Penguin, and then DC would be like, what?
Then they'd have to rename them something else.
I got a couple of quick hits. I got a follow-up that the Black Panther's third issue came out, where he's paired up with one of his sleeper agents, and they're out trying to alert the other Wakandan sleeper agents that he has placed around the globe, and figure out what this samurai hit squad is all about. And they, in issue 3, go to Mars, and we get to have a see what the current status quo of the T'Challa and Aurora Storm relationship is, which was really nicely presented. This writer really knows his Black Panther and knows his way around how to present, you know, like, legacy mythology of a character without interrupting the story flow of what he's doing, and do it in a very comic book way. John Ridley is the writer, and the artist is Juan Cabal, with Ibram Mustafa in the third issue. But a real good issue. This book continues to be interesting because they get to check in on a different agent who's in a different scenario every couple of issues here. And so you get it's steered in another direction. It's very international espionage-ish almost. Kind of cool. And then the other is the Black Widow issue number 13, a series that I have not been enjoying that much. This is written by Kelly Thompson with art by Raphael Pimentel. And this issue 13 is part 2 of 4, but is a great standalone issue that shows the first time that Natasha, the Black Widow, encountered Living Blade, this swordsman person. And it's back when she was short hair, wearing the gray Frank Miller costume in the 80s. And this encounter with this guy, I mean, she just gets all stabbed up and sliced up and she's bleeding all over the place. It's kind of one of the things that bothers me about Black Widow comic books in the last decade or so. It's like she gets stabbed way too much and recovers way too quickly. But this issue has her dealing with this guy and trying to get from point A to point B. So it's a very straightforward issue where you're right locked into the battle and it's a chase scene, the whole issue. And I found it really engaging, and it was a real page turner and it drew me right in. And I think I'll have a better chance of enjoying the next issue based on what this issue was and wasn't.
Yeah, I think that was one of the stronger issues of the run.
Nice. What else you got, Kevin?
Why is there a Canadian price on this comic book? I'm assuming these were all like drawn in because it's as a corner box, like that classic whole thing done up on here. This is She-Hulk with the Jen Bartel cover, which is pretty nice.
It sure is. Purple and green. When does that not work, you know?
Yeah. I was pretty fearless ordering this, knowing that for several years I had, usually at year-end specials, we would mention a few books, and I'd be like, hey, I enjoy the Runaways. So, yeah, that's where Rainbow Rowell and, yeah, comes from. And then on art, we have Raj Antonio, I'm guessing. I noticed this time, like, it's really comic book names, and I'm like, I have no idea if these are the actual names. Sometimes I look up names, and then it'll give you a pronunciation guide. Well, if you're in the UK, you'll pronounce it this way. If you're in Canada, and then I'm like, this isn't helpful, guy. Like whatever website is giving you like totally different ways to say the same name. But anyhow,
you tried. Your heart's in the right place.
I know, right? Like when I look up some kind of titles for even comic books, and sometimes they're named weird things, and I'm like, they have some sci-fi term or something, and then I'm like, yeah, that wasn't really helpful.
I read this issue too, and so get into it, and then because I want to comment on what I thought of the art.
The art, I would say, falls into that realm of like they could have done some Runaway stuff. Like it's sort of in that style. I must say this is probably better than the previous. Was she gray and angry and
right,
everything?
Right.
Like I didn't dig that one that much.
And she was so lumpy. You know, she's still curvy in this. Not as lumpy.
I would say this is much closer to the series we've gotten in the past couple decades, like the Slot and the Soul runs.
Or even before that, like I liked the idea. Even back in the John Byrne time, even way back when Mike Vosburgh was drawing the first series, there was something that was unique to She-Hulk and clever that she enjoyed being the She-Hulk more than she enjoyed being Jen once she was in control, right? And, you know, and because she's big and glamorous and she, you know, it was that was a fun take on a Hulk character. But this brings back the Jen Walters mousy persona physically and mentally. But I thought the portrayal of both She-Hulk and Jen and the characters around her were really good. The dialogue was really good, too.
Yeah, like this is after the events of Avengers 50 where she's slimmed down. But I mean, slimmed down for a Hulk, like. It's just funny to say slim down, but she was extremely buff and everything during that Avengers run.
Now she's back to being somewhat curvy.
Yeah. So there's just so many good bits in here, and like Marvel Comics, like continuity things. Like she was always fighting Titania.
Yeah.
And then, like, they have, like, a bout here. They enjoy fighting each other.
The characterization of Titania was great too. That it was really good.
And then at, like, one point, she's even feeling, like, sorry for Jen. Like, what? This is your only piece of clothing and everything? Like, I guess she wasn't, like, she didn't have all this stuff for all those years because she seemed to bounce around to all these different books. And, like, she's always beating things up in some headquarters or place or on the run or whatever. I'm like, yeah, I guess you don't have a lot of belongings, do you?
I thought the art was really good, like the page design and the storytelling, like no problems with it, just bringing me right through the book and being engaging. It's just the lines were are pretty scratchy for ink lines. Like I'd like to see an inker with a bolder line and some varying line weight. And like the details aren't all there with some of like the far away shots because of the scratchiness. Like the faces would be, I think, more tightly rendered if there was a embellisher or an inker working over pencils that looked like this. I mean, I don't know if this artwork is done digitally or not. It really is fine, but I just think it could be a little like the lines themselves, I think, need to be a little less chaotic.
I guess we run into that more nowadays since like you get the color artist, but you don't really get the whole inker thing
Right.
going on. So you're like wondering if it's digital or the artist themselves is just like throwing everything together. Like if they're doing like maybe they're just like doing quick breakdowns and then going right to the full figure right away rather than I don't really know.
This is good, though. This is a good start for a new She-Hulk book.
Yeah, like you have some other surprises in here from other runs, and then that ending. So yeah, definitely looking forward to the next issue of that.
Andrew, got any others?
Well, I was inspired by that book, and they really talked about a series I had read a little bit of. So just to go back and do a full, deep kind of reread, and that's the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, which
Oh.
had one short series in 2015, lasted like 8 or 9 issues, the OGN, and then the series that went for like 4 years. And that's what I read those first two. Now I'm in the middle of that 4-year run, and that's the North Henderson, at least the ones I've read so far.
Yeah.
And just a lot of fun. Like it's, they're really well built to read in batches. North does a lot of fun little marginalia where it's kind of like a commentary series and little jokes, somewhat sometimes fourth wally, sometimes not. And it's just like a fun world that the two of them create and populate with Squirrel Girl and her cast of characters, who I'm unfamiliar with, the Chipmunk Hunk and all those Toy Boy, and I don't know if they're original to that or whatever, but it's just this fun world of them taking on challenges. She's going off to college, and just in sort of a goofy, funny way that Marvel, I always associate them with kind of those coming of age characters, you know,
Yeah.
starting with Spider-Man back in the original X-Men now. And it's just, and I'd read a few issues here and there, but like I said, sitting down and getting fired up and reading chunks, it's going much better because you get into the rhythm of it.
Yeah, I was
I'm assuming you
tracking down
guys
some of
read some
the
of the issues.
Craven.
I don't know if you've read the whole. And the other thing is it's done, which made it easier too. But I also wanted to say, a buddy of mine sent me a big package of stuff, and there's a ton of the Marvel cards. So
Oh.
if either of you, I have a duplicate Spine Dark Riders. So, you know, if either of you need that.
You mean the X-Men villains, the Dark Riders?
Yeah, it's the Joe Kubert. They're kind of chromish colors. Like they're shiny.
Course they are.
You guys remember that series? I mean, he sent me a bunch of the Impel ones and the Team Up ones, and like it's just a big bag of random cards, but they're all very 90s. Like, I don't know who Spine is. I admit I feel a little embarrassed calling myself a comic fan, but there's Hurricane, Genesis, Gauntlet, Deadbolt.
Wow.
I have one of those on my door. So anyways, I have some dupes if you guys need that. You know, if you're like, man, I just need one more spine to finish my collection.
Too funny.
I have a major victory. Anybody, guys?
Sounds like
a
major
victory.
I have a
major victory.
Some cool team-ups. I didn't realize Spider-Man and Dark... Deathlok, Steve, very big in the 90s.
Yeah.
I did not appreciate what a superstar he was. He's on 800 different trading cards.
Yep. That backpack. Yeah,
those trading cards were weird.
That backpack of his should have gotten a trading card all its own.
Well, I always associate him more with the 70s.
Well,
I'm guessing
good
he was
Deathlok.
More popular in the 90s.
Yeah, well, he had the miniseries and then the ongoing that lasted several years.
And he teamed up with the Punisher.
Yeah, Silver Sable, he teamed up with, didn't he?
Sure. It was the 90s. Everybody teamed up with everybody.
Yeah. Also, if you miss mullets, you're really in luck flipping through these things.
That's how I feel when you're reading
fun.
The Warriors.
And all the different styles are... I miss the trading card thing. I know you guys are like them. So for me, it's just neat seeing all the different, what they put on the different ones. And because there's this one series here that have no borders. They're just like panels from the comics.
It was kind of fascinating to see what characters would make it into the set.
Yeah.
Not putting any trade dress on the front, just the image. So yeah. Wolverines from then till now series.
The main Marvel Universe set each year was real fun to... And what things they would do at the end, very fun. All right, I got a couple other quick hits for you. One is Star Wars issue number 20, written by Charles Soule, with art by Marco Castillo. And this has Luke Skywalker on a quest to find out what's in this data. Kind of like an orb, but it's a cube. And he goes to this planet, and the whole surface of the planet is all like these like mushrooms, and he has to go into the planet and he like submerge into the mushrooms, and then he has this big hallucinogenic, you know, like walkabout mystical journey and everything that puts him in touch with the Force and everything, and it's pretty cool. Pretty psychedelic for a Star Wars comic book, but fun because I like when science fiction plays on different cultural things like that, different ways to get knowledge and have it jacked up and exaggerated into a sci-fi type of situation. Kind of fun.
Hey, Star Wars is a space western, so
exactly, exactly. A little peyote never hurt Yoda too much. The other is Defenders number 5, that limited series wrapped up. And we finally get to learn who the Masked Marvel is. This is Al Ewing and Javier Rodriguez. This is the Defenders going back to the universe before ours and having that whole big adventure and everything. But it really wraps up the masked cosmic rider guy that was introduced back in the, what was it, Marvel 1000 or something like that?
I think so.
And
yeah, that series isn't like on best of lists. I know it's split between 2 years, so some people are like, well, you can't have a series that hasn't finished. Like, that Defender Sealed series is just wild, absolutely wild.
Yeah. Did you get to the ending?
I've only read the fourth one with the CMYK thing.
I'm not going to say another thing then.
Okay.
All right. Did you, though, Kevin, read the last Darkhawk number 5?
Not yet.
Oh, all right.
Because, I mean,
I know we weren't hot on it, so I
kind of let it slide for a little bit.
This series needed to be read in one or two chunks, because this last issue makes me forgive some of the other stuff that was going on, because it resolves the first arc and, you know, closes this chapter of this new Darkhawk. There's I mean, it does the stuff with him and the illness and the team. It does more of his relationship with Miles Morales that I didn't expect to be such a big part of the book. The bully of the school being one of the bad guys that he faces as Darkhawk, all cybernetic, jacked up, and him being the big bad. And then there's just a couple other things that I can't even hint at because you haven't read it yet, Kevin.
I guess I should have read all these things.
But now you will, right? Now you'll be like, all right, I got to read that last issue of Darkhawk and see what the thing is.
Yeah, got to get around to that. Yeah, guess what I was busy reading?
What?
More Hawkeye with Kate Bishop.
I read these too.
And this is another situation where I'm like, do you want me to horribly mispronounce someone's name? I mean, it's a comics tradition.
People should be feel privileged to have had their names butchered by you.
So maybe this is Marika Nootkamp, I'll go with. And then the penciler is Enid Balvum. Let's go with that. So even though I didn't know who they were, you sort of go, well, I'm down for reading anything Kate Bishop, pretty much. Unless we get some, I don't know. It would have to be a really bad series for me to be like, I don't know if I should be reading these Kate Bishop books anymore. But, you know, you get the preview pages and all that, and I'm like, this seems fine. And then I get to read it, and I'm like, no, it's good. It's good Kate Bishop story still coming out.
Agreed. I think it's Mariki Nootkamp and Enid Blom.
Okay.
But that would be me. That'd be my version. I think similarly to the She-Hulk book, really liked the characterization and the dialogue. And I really like the plot too, Kevin. I mean, for those listeners who have heard me on Indie Comic Book Noise, you know that my formula for being drawn in to a new series is to have the character be pulled out of a complex world and put into a simple situation that's engaging and limit the number of characters. This is a engaging, mysterious, intriguing scenario. And one of Kate Bishop's strengths is the fact that she's so connected. She's part of all these teams and team books, and she's made connections all over the Marvel Universe. So send her on vacation. Perfect.
Yeah. Well, perfect. It's kind of funny because I'm like, they sort of play with some of the, like, other characters could be showing up. And it's like, America's like, should I hop over there and help you out? And she's like, no, it's fine. And you're like, oh, once she's going to get, if she's going to get to New York, but then she's all caught up in this weird, like, vacation mansion thing that gets sort of like, it's a cutaway thing where you know where all the people are. It gives you the layout of the land. And then her estranged sister is there too. So, and then there's like some other stuff that's gone missing. And you're just like, what is happening with this weird place?
Yep, the sister being there is important because that lets it be a personal story. To go back with her and her father and all that stuff. I thought that's all well played. What do you think the art, though, Kevin? I mean, it's interesting. I'm torn because there's some really frustrating inconsistencies, like the character size shifts.
Yeah.
Which her and her sister are, which is taller, shifts way too much. And the proportions aren't consistent either. Bodily. Like the musculature, his choice of distortions is sometimes, you know, it looks like a thigh with a shark bite out of it because the side of it's so emaciated, that kind of a thing. And, like, the faces are so weird. Sometimes they're like a almost like a Tom Rainey type of a face, how he illustrates. But other times, and unfortunately many times, the proportions are really off and the faces are really wonky and sometimes downright amateurish, if I dare say. But I'll be damned, the storytelling is really, really solid. Really solid.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things, rather than things like super flashy. If you get the storytelling down, like that really helps.
You're darn right.
Yeah, I also had the, like, if this was my first time, like, reading a Kate Bishop story, I wouldn't have any preconceived notions. So that's also, you're trying to fit it in with what has been previously established. And, like, I'm looking at her haircut and everything, and I'm like, I mean, it's not wrong, but my brain is sort of, like, trying to piece out everything. I'm going, okay, that's just, you know, the artist is putting their spin on everything. So you're like, some things look weird, but not necessarily wrong. And you're like, yeah, that's all right, I guess. I guess I compare it to when you're used to a certain X-Men art and then they throw you something like Frank Whiteley. Like, that takes you a few issues if you've never seen Frank Whiteley before. You're like, what is going on with the art, before you start getting more appreciation? What is happening?
And then just when you get used to that, they throw in the Igor Cordy issues, and then you're like, what? Yes. No, I really don't know. I can't tell if Emma is a man or a woman.
Yeah, it's been fun to see Kate involved in another mystery and see all this craziness going down.
All right, I've got Andrew and Kevin with me to cover what I've been wanting to cover for, I think it's been on the back burner for like 2 calendar years now, that I've wanted to revisit this series, because we covered Moon Knight, like his publishing history, way back when we were doing that, back on Marvel Noise episode 110.
Whoa, that was before me.
In March 2010, it was Dave Kay and I going through the old Moon Knight set of series and kind of how his history played out. And we, you know, had to just touch upon each series quickly and didn't really, you know, sink our teeth into any of them. And I had only read this series once before and really have wanted to revisit it. And that is the 89 into the 90s Mark Spector Moon Knight series.
I'm live from Freedom Town. Actually, I'm not. Like, that I'm not in that country. I don't even know if that city actually exists on this world. Probably not.
I thought you had all them atlases, Kevin, that had the whole everything mapped out of the Marvel U.
Yeah, I wonder if it's in there, because I do have those two issues. Huh. Maybe. I just don't remember it.
Now, to set the stage, Mark Spector, who it becomes Moon Knight, dissented against his fellow soldier for hire, Raoul Bushman, who's got this tattooed face and sharp, pointy teeth and everything. He's a real bad guy. When Bushman murdered an archaeologist and then was about to do the same to the archaeologist's adult, very beautiful blonde daughter, Marlene. And Spector gets left to die in the desert overnight, and does, but was revived by the spirit of the moon god Khonshu and became Moon Knight, taking Bushman down as his first mission. And he first appeared in Werewolf by Night and a few issues in Marvel Spotlight and the backup black and white mag Rampaging Hulk series. Then he had a 38-issue series that ended in the beginning of 1984. That was really where I fell in love with the character, and he became a top-five character for me. That Munchensenkevich run, and even the stuff that followed with Kevin Nolan and Carl Potts, etc., really good stuff. Then, after that 38-issue series, about a year later, Moon Knight had a second series, but it only ran for 6 issues, and that was Moon Knight Fist of Khonshu. And that ended in September 1985, with the loose ends being wrapped up in the West Coast Avengers, where Moon Knight went on to operate for a while. And that's when I left comics. I left in the spring, like April of 1985, kind of in the middle of this Fist of Khonshu series, and didn't come back until 1990, when Silver Surfer 35 hit the stands, when Moon Knight, the Mark Spector Moon Knight title that we're about to get into, was on issue 13 or 14. I picked that book up the next month. What, there's a Moon Knight book? And then went and got these back issues. So about 3.5 years after the Fist of Khonshu book ended, so Moon Knight had really been tabled, in late February 1989, his third series begins, Mark Spector Moon Knight, which ends up having a 5-year, 60-issue run right into the beginning of 1994. The book started being written by Chuck Dixon, and that's whose run I would really like to cover here episodically. I think we can do it in 5 or 6 chunks.
And I think so. I've got a weird Moon Knight history.
Steve, you need to tell people you quit comics because they were going to cancel the Fist of Khonshu series.
Dixon had only done Savage Sword of Conan for Marvel at that point, I think. I mean, later he'd totally kill it on Punisher, but this would be his, you know, I think first work in the color comics, at least his first ongoing.
I think of him as Airboy, right?
Didn't sure. he do that? Yeah, he had done that beforehand, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I think of him for.
And I think of him as like doing that Airboy, a whole universe of books in a certain franchise at the Distinguished Competition. DC's Daredevil.
I think you'll find the Airboy was not DC, Kevin.
He did a bunch of Star Wars work for Dark Horse, and he did all kinds of stuff. Then these issues are drawn by Sal Velluto and Mark Farmer, who are fresh off of a few issues of Power Pack that, to be honest with you, didn't really look that good. But here, Velluto really leveled up. Farmer's still in his early days and would improve as the series goes on.
See, I saw it was Velluto on here, and I was like, oh, that's going to be good, because I just remember all those Black Panther issues from Marvel Knights.
Yeah. And the editor of the book was Carl Potts, which is notable because he was very familiar with the character. I mean, he's Mr. Alien Legion, right? But he had inked a few issues over Kevin Nolan of the first series and drew the iconic cover of number 32, where Moon Knight's coming down and he's got the truncheon in his hand. I have a recreation of that drawn by Mr. Potts hanging on my wall.
Interesting. I don't think I've seen Carl Potts' artwork. I don't think of him as an artist. Ooh, usually.
Yeah, he just wasn't fast enough to do sequentials on a regular basis, but his covers and inks and the occasional interiors that he would do were a real treat. He was a really cool artist. He would do different logos and stuff. He was a jack of all trades, like a Bob Budiansky type, you know? So in these, the first 3 issues of the book are the Hunter's Moon arc that reintroduces Moon Knight into the Marvel Universe here, with Spectre returning to New York from California after he had been there during his tour of duty with the West Coast Avengers, and he's getting reestablished, even buys the old Grant Mansion back on Long Island that he used to operate out of.
Yeah, Hunter's Moon, that name sounds familiar for some reason.
You think? And Frenchie's back, his side, not really sidekick, his partner, who used to be one of the...
He's a sidekick. He's he's not the main character of this thing. He's the flunky.
So Hindsight Lad and all those characters from New Warriors are sidekicks?
He's his pilot. They used to be together in their mercenary days in Bushman's group and have been friends for life. And he was always piloted the moon copter, and here he's piloting a all-new copter. That's pretty fancy.
Steve, if you're not wearing an outfit, you're a side. He's the Rick Jones of this whole thing. He's going to get the team brigade on the CB.
This is weird, but I had flashbacks. When they show certain scenes with the mooncopter, it reminded me of the V-Wing. But you remember that one issue of Thunderbolts? Where was it, the annual or whatever, where it looked like you could go inside? It's just like it reminds
right.
me. Except actually, this one you can go inside. For the V-Wing, you couldn't.
It's even a tight fit, though.
Showed that you could.
Yeah. But Moon Knight has always been important for the supporting cast around him. He never was a solo act. He had Frenchie. His butler was even an important guy, Samuels, in the first series. And Marlene would do like undercover work for him at times, and getting materials, reconnoitering, that kind of thing. And Crawley was his voice on the street, his ear to the ground, and the Gina at the diner, and her kids ended up being regular ongoing. So building up a new cast and establishing that some of the old favorites are still there is very Moon Knight-ish. There's a new butler. It's not Samuels now. It's Chloe, who is scantily dressed and making me have like the Jessica Rabbit bug eye thing going. Boing, 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 boing.
Yeah, that's a heck of an outfit to do work in, like cooking.
I was like, when he looked at everyone's resume, and then he said, "Well, can you do this in a bikini?" Like, he had a bunch of boxes he needed checked for the job.
Can you get the thing from the lower drawer? And Marlene's back, and that is an opportunity to, have it play off of, her reaction to seeing Chloe's outfit and all that, which is fun. And there, important to note too, there's no Jake Lockley or Stephen Grant personalities needed here. He's Spectre.
Yeah.
And he came back, and he's using his money, and he's... those were tools of the last two series ago,
I guess I'll drop this here, Steve. If this was a modern take, I think we would say, look, they took all these unique things out of Moon Knight and they stripped them down, and now he's like some mercenary dude that street level that beats up crooks with a bit of an edge. And I don't know how, maybe for all I know, that was a pitch to get Moon Knight back into action in 1989, right?
Well, that's what Chuck Dixon would make his bread and butter on soon when he would do The Punisher.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's just the kinds of stories he wanted to tell and the take he wanted to do. But also, you got to understand that at the end of Moon Knight's series, after Munch left, the first series, the last few issues there was a, and I actually, Munch might have written the two-parter that had the return of the werewolf, Jack Russell. Well, Moon Knight got bit, and when he got bit, he gained some lunar powers, some stronger at nighttime, that kind of a thing. But he also, in the Fist of Khonshu series, started showing some like schizo mental illnessy stuff based on the stress of juggling the different roles, the different characters he was playing. Okay? But they made that go away with his powers and attributed it to the lingering effects of the werewolf's bite.
Hmm.
Okay. And there had been a lot of mystical stuff with Moon Knight. Was he possessed by Khonshu? Was he brought back to life? Does the spirit inhabit him? If the statue gets broken, does he lose his mojo? Or is it really him? There was a lot of mysticism, Doctor Strange-y stuff happening at the end of the series, and then into that Fist of Khonshu series, it continued with the mysticism stuff. Then they put him in the West Coast Avengers, right? This is wiping that. You might say it took away what was interesting about him, but it also took away what had become burdensome to the character, I think. But they needed to get a, like, there hadn't, they hadn't done this whole he's mentally ill thing. They won't do that for a long, long time to come. They only touched upon it a little bit. So, you know, and this whole being a Fist of Khonshu even had only been introduced in that other series, that he was somehow a, you know, on a mission from Khonshu. Even that wasn't a core part of the character, but there was always this mystical, they took out the supernatural, and what they're left with was him, you know, beating down punks on the street, which, and Frenchie even makes a comment about that, like, you know, we're doing this again, you know, and he's like, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, someone could think, oh, like, he's more generic, like, he's more like Night Thrasher or whoever, right? But it's, like, a few issues in here, and I'm, like, really enjoying myself. But then I realize, like, the things I also like the mental stuff, that's fine. And then the Khonshu, I'm like, that's cool. But I'm like, none of that stuff is, like, in these issues. But it's the series still works, and I still think it's good. So I'm like, you don't need that stuff. But it seems like that could have went off on the wrong path, too.
This Moon Knight should coexist with the Moon Knight that does that stuff, like how the old X-Files show used to have like a case of the week episodes, and then like they would have the ones that addressed like the big story and the mystical stuff too, and then it would go, and that's how Moon Knight, I think, works best. It stretches back and forth from some of the mystical Khonshu stuff to, and you can see why some of my frustration in recent decades, when all they're doing is the mystical and mental illness stuff, they've lost this stuff. When was the last time you saw Moon Knight go on an adventure and take down, you know, a group of punks who's, you know, you know, threatening Gina at the diner or whatever?
I mean, some people would argue like they don't want to see superheroes just regular street punks or whatever. I mean
this is 89, man. This is new. Yeah, this is fresh. This is hip.
And even has like that scene where he's like up above and he's ready to take on some guys, and I'm like, when you're reading 80s 90s comics, I feel like there's always that scene.
Yeah,
well, like every comic starts with that scene. But it's so funny with the Nova 70s things we're reading. And I'm like, I can totally tell, like, this is not the 70s. Like, this isn't modern. Like, there's certain things that stick it to an era. But I'm like, this is still, this doesn't feel, like, super out of place or anything. And I slide into this very easily.
I think one of the fun hallmarks of this that reads 80s to me is that weird mix of, like, casual gun use, but weird arbitrary lines being drawn about what you kill and what you don't.
Like, yes,
he has Frenchie unleash 20mm cannons, and but then there's, then he's hitting guys with his sticks, and it's just this weird. And that was a lot of books had that weird mix, but I think the Sienkiewicz stuff for me, Steve, is what put Moon Knight on my map. I think what always held him back for me was, they didn't give him that iconic rogues gallery.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like too often they wanted to rotate around the same handful of dudes. And even if they're goofy or whatever, you just need a lot of weird stuff or steal from some other hero or whatever, you know, a weird crew of like Stiltman or whoever you want to make it fun. And then, cause those help define, cause he has all the attributes, I think, of a more prominent hero, but you really do need the villains, I think, to jump to that next level.
Yeah. I mean, he has some decent villains. I mean, as good as probably Daredevil. Like,
no, I feel like Daredevil's got the aforementioned Stiltman and the Jester and the Kingpin and Bullseye. Like, I just feel like there's this weird, I like the Gladiator. I just think there's all these kind of fun, goofy villains that he's had. He even mixes it up with other people's villains a lot, the Enforcers and
Spider-Man. Feel like Daredevil has a very small, a great, like he might beat Moon Knight, like in, like Daredevil has greater villains, but he doesn't have like a wide gallery of villains.
Well, name the iconic Moon Knight villains. Okay, you got Bushmaster. Now keep
Stained Glass, Scarlet, Black Spectre,
Morpheus.
Yeah.
And
like some kind of crazy Khonshu stuff, or like Werewolves on the Moon or something.
Yeah, that's what you don't have. Well, like I said, if they just pumped in a steady row of C-list loser villains, like some of them are going to hit, you know?
Yeah, when they did that Hit It story, you know, that Munch and Sienkiewicz, and they started to do stories that were not necessarily the villain of the month, that's for sure. But anyway, and that's a good segue here, because the threat, the conflict, is that Bushman's back. And he kidnaps Marlene at the end of the first issue. He'd hired some computer geeks to, like, investigate and keep tracks on Spectre, and hadn't been seen since the first series, issues 9 and 10, when he was beaten up, like, to a pulp by Spectre and then imprisoned. But now he set himself up as the general and, like, president for life of the country of Burunda, which apparently is his homeland.
Yeah, the geek stuff kind of leaves me a little cold. Very what you would imagine the 80s portrayal of poorly socialized computer guys.
Well, they didn't have the soft skills back then.
Moon Knight cases out the Burundian embassy in the second issue, knowing that Bushman is probably hiding Marlene behind the protection of diplomatic immunity. And Bushman's onto him and sets a trap. This messenger who Moon Knight follows into Central Park, and then there's a crack squad of Burundian tribal warriors that then follow him.
And a very 80s crossover appearance that reminded me of many classic books where you tease something and sort of deliver.
Yeah, Moon Knight takes out the tribal warriors first with a chase, and then beats up the rest of them in the park. Welcome to my jungle.
It is a guest cameo.
Yeah.
Did he bring these pictures to Jonah? And he's like, why are you bringing me Moon Knight pictures? I want pictures of Spider-Man.
Yes, Spider-Man in his cameo sees these tribal warriors and follows and sees that Moon Knight's got it well in hand. So just thanks him for getting some pictures for the Bugle.
But you got to put Spider-Man on the cover for that page.
Yeah, that's
and a
weird
half
too.
Hey, this is the late 80s, early 90s. Wait till the next segment we have, when it's like Spider-Man and the Punisher and the Ghost Rider all making.
Oh, you know. See, that's how I think I got that initial love for Moon Knight, when it's like Nova, Punisher, Ghost Rider, like all those 90s.
Yep.
Sort of ish guys are all teaming up and crossing over with each other, and then I sort of like get into Moon Knight, but it's past this run, so I don't stick around long, and I'm like, oh, some of these issues are terrible, and then I'm like out. And which probably starts the, is Moon Knight good? And I can say, yes, Moon Knight is good. I like Moon Knight. I can confirm Moon Knight is good.
Moon Knight gets the message from the messenger that Bushman wants $10 million for the girl. Cut to Spectre being told he doesn't have $10 million that could be liquidated into cash.
I like that they say he's not paper rich.
Yeah, so he's going to have to do, you know, go
or
to...
Or that cash rich.
He's going to have anyhow. Rich.
Yeah.
He ain't rich. But
no one wants another... You can't get another mortgage on the mansion.
So he's got to go the rescue route, right? Go as Moon Knight. So he sneaks into the Burundian embassy to find Marlene, disguised as a cable guy, Holmes. He's calling it, every other word out of his mouth is Holmes. It's obnoxious. But, you know, that's his move, right? He does disguises and plays a role. This is this is how he did the Jake Lockley bit. This is how he did Stephen Grant, because he was hiding that Spectre was behind his money.
Well, it's funny that is there, and then you think of, like, modern writers were looking at, I don't know if they were looking at this, maybe they were just looking at the first run, and they're like, well, we need to do this, but we need to up everything. And then they, what conclusions they came to, like, reading old Moon Knight is interesting.
So Moon Knight's searching the compound door by door. Of course, he finds these big guys in the gym and has to fight through them. He reaches Marlene's chamber, but Bushman's brought her back to Burundo with him. And now her life is basically forfeit, since he couldn't produce the money. So in the third issue, Spectre travels to the Central African nation of Burundi undercover as a photojournalist. Again, this is his move, right?
It's true. This is what he does.
Put on a mustache and sunglasses, he's ready to go. Bushman has Marlene decked out like a yacht model, and luckily she hasn't been harmed because he needs her as bait.
Like, they use that sort of Claremont-ish accent for some of the characters, and by 4 pages in, you're like, ouch, stop saying things like that.
Yeah, definitely. Bushman telling Marlene and showing what the Burundian kingdom is like under his rule, you know, he solved the AIDS epidemic.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure I know what Bushman would do against COVID. Yeah. Like, you don't need...
He would like the Chinese. He just locked the people in their... Locked them in their... Bolt them in their houses and let them starve to death. So Spectre waits until nightfall and sneaks out of the hotel as Moon Knight, like, makes a distraction by blowing up a weapons depot and a fuel tank. Looking really cool with the silver bow. I like that look. Then there's this side scene of Frenchie gathering resources. He's buying a helicopter from an adjacent nation's militia. He can, you know, he's been a mercenary. He can come up with resources anywhere. Moon Knight faces Bushman in his compound's courtyard, and it's like a fight for Marlene. Man-to-man. Well, man-to-man with a sword.
Yeah.
I thought this was where Dixon's going to get better, but it was unconvincing, the reason. And Moon Knight calls him on it, and then that's it. And I'm like, well, it is like a weird... I kind of wish he hadn't raised the question at all.
Yeah, well, they've known each other a long time, these two, you know? They've hated each other a long time.
That's why I'm like, they could have just not raised that question.
Yeah.
Just gone. Because raising it without an answer just leaves it lingering in my head. But I do like the portrayal of it. Like, he's a physically imposing dude. And I like the more... This is still the era of, like, lean and mean. We haven't hit the 90s where Moon Knight would have, like, you know, 50-inch arms and everything. Like, they're more that athletic, muscular kind of thinner build, which I think is a fun treat, where, you know, his opponent's the big crazy guy whose back is like twice the size of anyone else's.
You don't want to see abs on abs?
Yeah.
Abs have other abs.
They fight for 3 pages, but Moon Knight comes out on top with the help of Marlene wielding a automatic machine gun and Frenchie's timely arrival with the copter.
Yeah, I think how Marlene gets into the action and everything.
I think Marlene stopped him by wielding that bikini, Steve.
Everyone stopped. Bushman's basically humiliated and used as a human shield while they escape, but they leave him to stay in power. And the last panel is pretty cool, I think. It really conveys a lot. Bushman's rage with the offset color phantom image of him. And then this like James Bond-esque dialogue with Marlene, like, oh, Mark, you know.
It was just missing a bad pun in a freeze frame to be part of a TV show of the era.
Yeah, but it's talking about going and spending time on the Riviera because she's dressed in a bikini rather than heading straight home. It seemed very Bond-esque.
He should have made some pun about the moon or something like that.
What I think is interesting, too, is that says Mark, that, you know, for those of you who read the first series, she was the one who, if anyone, was the mentally ill one who saw him as only Stephen Grant and couldn't accept that he was Lockley or Spectre. She was the one who was always calling him Grant and always calling him Stephen, and in some ways it felt like by the time the series was over, he was keeping it up because of her. Uh-huh. So it was very interesting that she's accepting him as Mark because she was really pushing the Stephen Grant identity in the first series.
I love the age-old tradition of new writer ignores the parts he doesn't like from the... I'm fine. You don't need some weird page describing why this is all. Just roll with it, man.
Yeah, I sometimes I really like the, like, yeah, if you don't need to mention it, oh, we won't mention it.
I think this was a good straightforward reintroduction to Moon Knight, though, with this three-issue arc, setting up his new status quo and getting, breaking inertia and bringing Moon Knight back. Nothing too fancy, nothing deep, that's for sure. It was it was popcorn for sure, but, you know, it was fun. All right, we're back in New York for a two-parter over issues 4 and 5. Issue number 4 has a guest artist on the cover and interiors of Russ Heath. Freaking Russ Heath, man. So good.
I guess you can tell with the way this begins. I'm like, yeah, that's the stuff.
And talking about different villains, I didn't want to say because I didn't want to spoil. Here's the other classic MK villain from the first series, the all dark blue Midnight Man, Andrew.
Yes, I do not elevate him to the classic level that you do, but I do enjoy that they've put Chloe back in her bikini outfit, because last time we saw her, she was in regular clothes. And I'm like, this ain't going to stay. You got to wear your employee outfit when you're on the clock.
The Midnight Man had last appeared in that last issue that Bushman did of the first series in issues 9 and 10. And that was his second or third appearance. So the issue opens with an almost completely silent sequence as a stealth-garbed high-rise thief is targeting Spectre's companies and assets. I like how the editor's names are on the nameplate as being part of the board of Spectre Corp. There's also an awesome Gil Kane-esque splash of Moon Knight in his costume, even though it turns out he's just looking in the mirror, looking at his new costume. But it looks cool, and I really like how in this series, and Russ Heath especially, go with that more Don Perlin depiction of Moon Knight, where you can see the mask under the hood. It's not just the eyes and the you know, the dark chasm like Sienkiewicz always did.
Yeah.
And Keith does faces and well-dressed folks so well.
Yeah.
You want to talk James Bond. This whole issue gave me the James Bond vibe.
So the robberies continue, and it seems like it's the Midnight Man, but he's dead, isn't he? Spectre sets a trap. He has a high-profile party. Again, as Spectre, no need to be Stephen Grant here. And who's in attendance, Kevin, but Felicia Hardy?
Yeah, as soon as I saw who that was, I'm like, whoa, that sticks out. Is that? Yeah, it's Felicia. I'm like, so good.
The Midnight... 10 years later, she'd warrant a cover appearance for this. I'm saying,
yeah, really.
Co-starring.
The Midnight Man creates chaos and strikes, ripping people's necklaces off and stuff, running through the place. Moon Knight chases him and faces him, and they fight and everything, and he escapes, but the Black Cat shows up as the issue ends.
That's definitely nice. You know what's weird about... We're reading through the issues, so I'm like, the Marvel bullpen bulletins, I thought these changed, like, every week? Like, maybe when I was reading them, they did, but I look at some of these, I'm like, is this the same one again? Like, they don't always have the, like, what's coming out this week and all that, like, I guess they had a different format before I was familiar with the format.
Issue number 5 in the summer of 89, back to the regular art team, which I kind of wish they kept Keith on the 2 issues since it was a 2-issue storyline, because it's kind of jarring going from, like, the Black Cat's depiction by Heath to Veludo Farmer.
For sure.
She's like a punk rock, like Joan Jett version of the Black Cat. But she doesn't know of Moon Knight. She never heard of this guy. She thinks he's the perpetrator. So that gives them an excuse to briefly tussle.
Yeah, it's not the first time someone will be like, what's your name, Moonbeam?
Hey, no one likes those West Coast Avengers.
True. Tackles. Who? No such thing. The FBI also want to question Moon Knight, so he has to make an escape with the Mooncopter. And
yeah, I like the corporate intrigue, definitely.
The Black Cat manages to stow away, but not in the mooncopter, on the external surface, which Yikes. Is a rough ride. But they chase the Midnight Man's car and the copter, and Moon Knight and the Cat swing down and they're like jumping from car to car and everything.
I like that Midnight has personalized license plate of Midnight for his car.
Just in case you didn't know whose car it was. Moon Knight reaches the Midnight Man, but they end up driving off of the bridge that they were on, and Midnight Man seems like he's likely lost and dead again.
Of course.
Until Spectre gets home and tries to grab a beer from the fridge, and it's like the Midnight Man's like right there. Hey, guys. Moon Knight mops the floor with him and unmasks him, and he's just a kid. Well, he's 19. And it turns out he's the son of the original Midnight Man and wanted to learn his dad's craft and did those thefts to show off because he wants to be Moon Knight's sidekick.
See, now, this is knowing this is Dixon and knowing what he goes on to write later on, he does another sort of sidekick story at the other publisher. So, like, not exactly the same, but I just found that interesting, too, that he's obviously interested in twisting that idea.
Well, I liked it. We not only have the regular crew, but we're now going to pump up the support. Like, it's...
Yes.
You want to use the existing support staff, but it's nice to add a piece to the mix.
With a connection to the old Moon Knight legacy and mythology, too.
Which yeah.
They've brought Bushman forth. They're now Midnight Man. And Moon Knight's pretty decisive, of course, that he works alone. Sorry, Frenchie. Even Frenchie's like, hey! And he's like, all right, well, almost alone. And my two thoughts were, one was, I have a bad feeling this is going to end like The Incredibles. And two is Kevin, Sidekick's Revenge. Like, we have to read these before we ever get to that. Remember that whole Sidekick's Revenge thing in Spider-Man?
Yeah.
With Nova?
You know, that probably would have read better if I would have read different. Like, I'm like,
see, now you're going to know.
Parts together now.
Right? That's fun.
Yeah.
So this issue ends with a 4-page sequence showing a weird trench coat wearing guy getting off the subway and walking up to some drug gang and killing the leader with a knife right on the street, despite being shot like a dozen times. Issue 6 begins a 2-part story involving Brother Voodoo.
Yeah, I was humming along, and then at the end it said, next issue, zombies, and I was like, oh, I don't know. And then, we get to Brother Voodoo, and I'm like, oh, all right.
Brother Voodoo hadn't been used very much.
Hanging out in the office and everything.
He's not, he doesn't pop up too often, but he did pop up in the first Moon Knight series. I don't know, maybe around issue 18 or 19, something like that. Moon Knight had a Voodoo Cajun adventure. So they know
Voodoo
each other.
Was making the rounds, like, to all the supernatural things, like Doctor Strange, Werewolf by Night.
Well, it fits with the pseudo mystical. It's nice to have a little. It's still vaguely street level, but it adds a little superhero twist to it.
Spectre's trying to address running his company, but it's not easy because he's been neglecting it, and they're going to be audited by the feds now. And oh man. And Brother Voodoo is waiting for Spectre in his office. He's been in pursuit of a cult that uses zombies as assassins. And he's been following them from Haiti.
Zambi.
Jambi.
I was going to say, is this like that thing from the 70s? They can't say zombies, so yeah. They strategically change the spelling?
The thing is
this the comics code type of thing?
Brother Voodoo's been turned into a zombie himself by this cult. And could you please pass the salty potato chips?
That was so weird.
But the explanation was good, because it had the whole silliness of, like, chips? Okay. And he's sitting there munching chips while they're talking, almost like an episode of Seinfeld, where, like, the characters are eating while they're talking, just as, like, something to do. And then it gets into, like, well, what's with the potato chips? And it's like, well, the salt helps me fight off the, you know, zombie poison. It's like, oh, all right, that's cool.
It's just not ironic. The last time we'll see him eating.
It's ironic that when I sit around eating potato chips, I turn into a zombie.
Yeah, right. But then later, right, when they're having like home fries or bacon or whatever, and they're like, dude, you're eating all the bacon. And he's like, mm.
Is that a cure, Steve? When you have low blood sugar, you eat a lot of bacon and everything?
Is there anything that bacon can't cure?
It's not. That's doctor recommended. Eat a lot of bacon.
Jericho Drum, Brother Voodoo, his powers and his brother's spirit are what are helping him not be controlled by the zombie master, who is a professor-looking doctor guy who makes and controls the zombies. And he's been hired by this crime lord, like low-level street crime lord guy, to take out all of the drug peddlers in town that are his competitors.
Just regular dudes.
He sends
no one famous.
He sends the zombie assassins after them, basically. Fortunately, a Jericho Drum can sense the proximity of the other zombie agents. So he and Moon Knight are able to foil an assassination.
And zombie senses tingling.
Right. And the Midnight Man was following them and comes in and kicks the suicide-bombing zombie assassin out the window and, like, perfect timing, does everything just right, and catches a bunch of flack for it because they thought he almost died.
These mobsters were a little too generic for me, Steve. Yeah. I need a guy with a weird-shaped head or a guy wearing a mask or some kind of
skin condition.
You want a Tombstone or the Slug or somebody like that? Jigsaw?
Not only did Midnight Man knock this bomber out the window of the high-rise just in time before the bomb went off, he also provides the getaway car. So he basically gets allowed to sort of hang with them now, at least for this case. And hanging around the mansion has some fun character moments with, like, the Midnight Man calling Jericho Drum Jerry. I thought it was funny. And the thing with the eating the bacon and stuff. And Hal, who is Spectre's chief financial officer at his company, calls and yelling about the audit and Spectre being AWOL and everything, and how there's all these odd expenditures that can't be explained and they're all related to his operations as Moon Knight, you know?
Yeah, apparently the IRS wants to know if you spend all this money on fuel and everything.
What's interesting is, in going back to us talking, I don't want to get too far ahead because we'll get into it in the next installment of revisiting this series, but this is leading towards the reason for him having that old Stephen Grant persona. Uh-huh. Because now that his name is public and attached to his money and his company and everything, and where his money came from, mercenary work and everything, they're going to come after him legally. And they're going to make life tough for him. And this is just the beginnings of that.
Well, he does mention or make jokes about, I should just publish my name in the paper. Everyone seems to know my identity.
Yep. In issue 7, Jericho Drum is able to track the zombies back to their source in the Bronx. So Moon Knight, Midnight Man, and Brother Voodoo storm the building. Moon Knight is bringing Midnight Man along more and more, like in a mentor role, you know, like stay close and watch your six and all that.
I like when they're zooming in here and then it has that weird orange, white, pink coming off like the engines.
The color palette on the covers and throughout the series so far have had some interesting choices at times, and it's, for the most part, worked for me, though.
Yeah.
The crime boss guy betrays the doctor, professor, zombie lord guy and shoots him in the gut and leaves him for dead with his undead. But he grabs a paper and sends his top zombie on some secret mission. Like you were saying, Andrew, about the gun violence, Jericho Drum is blowing away thugs left and right with a shotgun, like at point blank range too. It's brutal, really brutal.
He was just winging them. See, those are mercy bullets. Do we still use those in the thing?
Dude, that's like a paint can's worth of blood coming flying out of the shoulder of that Chicano guy. That's rough.
Yeah, it's really obvious.
And did you shoot the other guy in the crotch? I mean, it's terrible. It takes 5 pages of zombie stomping action for Moon Knight and Midnight to fight their way to Brother Voodoo's location, where they confront the dying doctor who is still sending zombies at them with his dying breath. Fortunately, when the doctor dies, the zombies are restored by Drum, including himself. He just probably needs a little chapstick. Those lips look pretty cracked.
Yeah.
Oh, and the zombies' final mission? That drug lord who shot the doctor is in the zombie sights. He gave him a picture of the drug lord. So he's like outside of his house and you know he's going to get him.
You know, for that guy, for some reason, reminded me of Forge.
That's too funny. But at the end, I got to say, I'm totally rooting for the zombie to get the drug lord guy.
Well, I like how zombies still have more wherewithal than your traditional zombie. You know, like they can use guns and like they're not just brains and staggering around type of thing.
Yeah, that was like Midnight had a few comments like that. Well, like what? They can lock doors? They can use tools? But regarding Midnight, I hope this doesn't get too Batman and Robin-y because let's face it, the parallels are already too many.
That's another thing with the whole stripped down thing. It's showing like his problems are even closer to that thing. Like he has all the money, and people are wondering how like he's spending this money. What do you spend that money on? Oh, he's gonna have to get a shell company, and then Lucius Fox is gonna come in. Like it's like ooh.
No, it's a Brutus Weasel is the guy he ends up hiring. To run the company.
I thought it was interesting too. At the end of this issue, they have an ad for Akira, and I'm like, if I would have read this back then, I totally would have not remembered that. But now, from a historical perspective, I'm like, wow.
Yeah. All right. So that's the opening 7 issues of the Mark Spector Moon Knight series, getting them back up off the ground. And like I said, I really want to at least revisit Chuck Dixon's run until he leaves the title sometime around issue 25, I think. After that, when things started getting crazy, when they started having editors writing the book and stuff, and armor and satanic connections, and everybody's related to each other, and
that's when I jumped on.
Ugh, no wonder you thought Moon Knight might be bad. It was then. It was.
I mean, I had a few of those splat issues, and I got rid of that whole batch because I was just like, man, this isn't good.
The art was interesting with Platt, and before it too, the Ron Garney art on some of those were not good issues was good. I mean, but the story was so bad.
So now I kind of wish I had at least the splat issues because those issues are a little pricey.
Are they?
Yeah.
Good to know. All right, next time we pick up on this series, maybe 2 episodes from now or so, we will get into the Axe of Vengeance tie-ins, where Dixon writes the Punisher for the first time as a guest star in these pages.
Is that a tryout, you think?
Definitely want him the job. All right, thanks, Andrew. Thank you, Kevin, for humoring me in doing this.
It was a joy, Steve.
Yeah, who doesn't like reading comics?
Next up, probably more New Warriors, because we are finally to what I consider the consistently good issues.
All right.
Yeah. All right, until Moon Knight runs out of crescent darts, make mine Marvel.
Can't he just use crescent rolls instead, Steve?
So does he mass produce?
He looks
cards?
A little Pillsbury Doughboy sometimes.
Like, does he manufacture a lot of them or retrieve them later? And then there's that whole thing, why you need all these made? What are you building in your company that needs a lot of crescents?
Retrieve them from the foreheads of his victims.
Yeah.
Later.